Good morning. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Brian, Judge Ross, Judge Bjorkman, the Honorable Judge Jeffrey M. Brian presiding. We're now calling case A20-0088 in the matter of Sauda Mohammed.
Good morning. Before we begin, I want to make sure that everybody can hear me and that my fellow judges are also able to be heard, and same for the attorneys. So why don't I start with Judge Bjorkman.
Good morning.
Great. I heard you loud and clear. Judge Ross?
Good morning.
Wonderful. Ms. Dobbins?
Good morning.
And Mr. Zhang?
Good morning.
Okay. Sounds like everybody is able to hear us. I want to say a few things before we begin. First of all, a thank you to everybody for being willing to participate remotely. I want to also note that there are sometimes unexpected glitches or interruptions, doorbells, family members, pets, that sort of thing. And I want to thank you in advance for your patience. We'll do the best we can to limit all of these interruptions during our conversations this morning. With that, one more comment, and that is about the clock. If you're in gallery view, you should be able to see the clock on the Marshall screen. So if you're not in gallery view, you can go to the top right-hand corner and toggle between the speaker view and the gallery view, and that way you know how much time is remaining. All right, Mr. Zhang, you may proceed.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Tuz Zhang with Southern Minnesota Regional Legal Services, representing relator Sauda Mohammed. Ms. Muhammad's 2018 annual recertification was unlike any recertification she had ever completed before. For the first time, she completed it without an in-person meeting with the CDA, without an interpreter, without any assistance from her former husband, Osman Mayani, and completed it entirely through the mail. In addition to all these changes, Ms. Muhammad was also tangling with a new form of income, what would be considered as child support for the purposes of the voucher program. And all these changes in her life, as well as the practices with the CDA, all fall on the backdrop of the 2017 annual recertification, where the CDA's interpreter scolded Ms. Muhammad, which resulted in chilling her from asking for further interpretive services from the CDA. Now, the CDA is required to comply with Title VI and various federal regulations when it comes to meaningful language access for limited English proficient participants, as well as the Violence Against Women's Act. And likewise, the CDA's hearing officer is required to follow those regulations in addition to making a decision that's in line with Carter v. Olmstead Housing Authority. But what instead happened was the CDA and its hearing officer turned a blind eye to those requirements and instead point the finger at Ms. Muhammad.
Can I interrupt you to ask you a question about the your argument about the Violence Against Women's Act? I don't really understand the argument. I don't see how it is that you're contending that this affected the decision or rendered the decision invalid. Can you summarize your argument in just a single sentence so I understand in summary exactly what your position is on the act?
Yes, there was evidence presented at the hearing that Osman Mayani, Ms. Muhammad's former husband, was abusive towards her, interfered and stopped her from learning English, and interfered and stopped her from asking questions during the briefings with the CDA. And therefore his domestic violence and interference with her ability to learn about the program as well as English in general prevented her from understanding the program, and therefore it's a direct result of the domestic violence, and she should have protection against them under the Violence Against Women's Act.
Okay, can you make that argument in the context of the language of the act? Explain to me how what you just described would render the decision in this case invalid based upon the Violence Against Women's Act. Use the language of the statute itself and incorporate that into your argument, because I still don't understand it.
If I may have a moment to pull up the language of the statute. The Violence Against Women Act prohibits termination on the basis that the applicant or tenant has been a victim of domestic violence, dating violence, sexual assault, or stalking. And furthermore, with any of the actions being the direct result of any domestic violence. So Ms. Muhammad's argument is that a direct result of Mr. Mayani's domestic violence against her made it difficult for her to be able to comply with the CDA requirements.
How did that form the base? How did her victimhood form the basis of the decision? That's the logical part that I think is missing from your argument.
Your Honor, could you repeat the question?
How did the alleged violence against your client form the basis of the termination?
So the strict basis of this termination was Ms. Muhammad's failure to report what would be considered child support in the voucher program. And that basis is strictly reporting one, but underlying that failure to report was Ms. Muhammad's lack of understanding of program requirements, which has contributed to not only her English proficiency, but also Mr. Mayani's domestic violence, which interfered with both her ability to understand English as well as specifically the program rules.
That seems like that it creates quite a string of tentative relationships between cause and effect from the alleged violence and the decision. Were you able to find a case anywhere in the country that would support that train of reasoning?
I've not found a case that's strictly on that basis, but the regulations.
Have you found a case that's even close?
A case, no, but there is guidance from HUD that there are several different bases that could support protections under VAWA, including even a increase in income or inability to report if the abuser interferes with that. So as an example that I believe is put out in some of the interpretations is that if the abuser interferes with the participant's ability to report to stop them from calling the CDA, for example, or if there's a loss in income and therefore failure to pay rent if it's public housing, because the abuser shows up at the tenant's workplace, forcing them to either quit or be fired because of issues that come up at the workplace, those can all fall under protections under VAWA.
Well, I can understand how those could be deemed direct result, or how a failure to comply with program requirements would directly result from that kind of conduct. But here, I mean, I think the argument is that years of the ex-husband discouraging her from learning English somehow is a direct result. I'm having a hard time understanding and agreeing with that argument.
Ms. Muhammad's position is that she did not understand the nuanced differences in reporting requirements for the CDA. So Ms. Muhammad in the past had reported that Mr. Mayani was providing her some income support after he had left the household initially in the 2018 recertification. And then afterwards, he was apparently in the hospital and it was reported to the CDA that that was no longer happening. But what was happening was Mr. Mayani would provide specific monies to Ms. Muhammad to pay for certain things. It would be like, this jacket, our son in common wants this jacket at Burlington. Here's $80 to buy it. The kids wanted to go eat out on Friday. Here's $100 to pay for that meal. That's what was happening after in 2018-2019. What Ms. Muhammad did not understand was that was still considered child support for the purposes of the voucher program. To her, she understood it as, this is money for my kids. I don't get to decide how this money is spent. I don't use it on rent. I don't use it for any of my personal needs. It is money for my children. I don't have a decision in this matter.
That doesn't sound like an interpretation issue, a language interpretation issue, but perhaps a legal interpretation issue.
And legally speaking, there is no difference between money for the children or for Ms. Mohammed, whether this is strictly court-provided child support or if it was provided to Ms. Mohammed by Mr. Mayani. For the voucher program, there is no difference there. But where the difference is Ms. Mohammed's understanding that sort of income coming directly to her for the purchase of specific items is still considered
income. Right, I understand that. What I'm saying is the difficulty, the breakdown in, I mean, assuming as true everything that you've said, I don't know if the record supports your position, but assuming as true everything you've said, that what she lacks is a nuanced understanding of what is and what is not child support, that doesn't sound like a language interpretation issue. That just sounds like a legal question that he may have had the same problems with, but it's not you haven't identified any English words that were misunderstood. You're describing a legal misunderstanding. I don't see how that fits your translation argument.
Well, turning back then to the language access issue, Ms. Muhammad has stated in the record, primarily speaks Somali, and being that the Hamari or Benadiri dialect. And for many years, the CDA did provide an interpreter to Ms. Mohammed for their annual recertifications. From 2014 to 2017, the process would be a mailing would go out to Ms. Mohammed indicating that in-person meeting was scheduled, and that in all of those meetings, including 2017, an interpreter, Somali interpreter, was always provided automatically by the CDA.
And your client never complained that she couldn't understand the interpreter or that there was any difficulty about the assistance being provided. Am I right about that?
Up until the termination proceeding, no. She would attend these meetings and the interpreter would go over the CDA's presentation about the participants' responsibilities. And then the interpreter would meet with the CDA's housing specialist and Ms. Muhammad, where they would go over each page of the recertification packet or application. Now, this is a pretty long and detailed process, and all that went out the window in 2018.
There was a long list in the Community Development Agency's brief identifying multiple telephonic conversations where apparently there was no interpreter involved and there was a full exchange of information and your client responding to the conversation by actions that demonstrated that she understood the details of each one of those communications. I didn't see in your reply brief any dispute about that characterization. Am I correct that you agree that all of those occasions occurred where your client engaged in oral communication and written communication without the need for an interpreter or the request for an interpreter, and that your client demonstrated that she had an understanding of the communications?
I would agree that Ms. Muhammad did not request an interpreter or indicate she had trouble understanding her housing specialist over the phone, but I would note that those are all oral communications and that there'd be a significant difference between oral communications and English for Ms. Muhammad and written communications as provided by the CDA for its 2018 annual recertification process. That application is entirely in English, as well as its cover letter, which solely indicated on the back page saying, more or less, if an interpreter is needed, you need to ask for one. And this is a material shift from 2017 and back.
Why is that a problem? If she's informed that if she needs an interpreter for the written communication, she needs to ask for one. Why is that a concern in this litigation if she received that notice but didn't ask for one?
It's a problem because at that point, the CDA is failing to provide meaningful access. It's no longer meeting its own administrative plan to affirmatively take steps to ensure meaningful language access to the program. In 2017—
I don't understand. If the agency advises a person in a language that the person understands, that if the person does not understand the document, a translator or a translation will be provided. How is that not affirmatively meeting the language needs of the client?
I think in practice, it has failed, and that's evidenced by the fact that the termination has proceeded in 2018. And
I don't understand. You're saying that because she didn't avail herself of the offer and she was terminated, that therefore she didn't have access? I'm not following your logic. I'm sorry.
No, it's that what the CDA was previously doing was affirmatively and automatically providing at least one interpreter a year. And then in 2018, the CDA took that interpreter away and instead wrote down on a piece of paper, said, if you still want one, ask. And that is a material change.
Let me jump in here, Mr. Shong. What in the record shows that your client cannot read English or is not literate in the English language, written English?
At the hearing, Ms. Muhammad stated that she has a first grade level understanding of English.
In what language on the document? Well, let me ask it a different way. I haven't seen this particular document that you're referring to. Is it in Somali or English that she's offered the opportunity to have a translator if she needs one, or both languages?
I see my time is just run. May I answer the question?
Please, go ahead.
The offer for an interpreter essentially appears in two ways. First, in English, that indicates if a participant requires a in-person meeting for as either a reasonable accommodation for a disability or to provide an interpreter is the first place, and that's a sentence in English. And then finally, it's also included in the CDA's language block, which is written in Somali and refers to a phone number that the participant may call. And that's the phone number, as indicated in briefing, that I had called. And the voicemail greeting is long, detailed, but is also entirely in English without any reference to interpretive services. Thank you.
Can I pause here? May I ask one more question, Judge Brian?
Of course, although I will say I'm having a hard time hearing you. I'm not sure if there's something with the mic, but you got awfully quiet all of a sudden.
You have a hard time hearing me?
Yes, you got, I can still hear you, but it's somehow much quieter than it was before. I don't know if you turned the volume down accidentally or something, but before it was a lot louder.
I haven't touched anything. Let me, is this any better?
Not really, but if you just speak up, I think we'll be fine.
All right. Is there anything in the record that would inform us that Ms. Mohammed called the number that was provided for an interpreter and received this, what you've described as a, from your own personal experience, a lengthy English description?
No, there's nothing in the record that indicates Ms. Muhammad did in fact call that number, but it does speak to the CDA's practices when it comes to language access.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Shong. Ms. Dobbins, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I am Mary Dobbins and I represent the Dakota County CDA. Under the Housing Choice Voucher Program, a participant's rental assistance is calculated based on their income. Generally speaking, the participant pays 30% of their income as rent and the CDA pays the remainder of the rent monthly to the landlord. Given that framework, it is essential that program participants completely and accurately report their income to the CDA. That's required.
I don't want to interrupt, but I want to just jump to it. I know the other judges on the panel are well prepared. We've read the briefs and the addendum and know the record well. But I think to focus your argument a little bit, maybe you could address one of the questions Judge Ross had asked Mr. Shong, which is relating to what is the language that someone who doesn't speak English would have a hard time understanding. And I think their discussion was about the meaning of child support or what is designated as child support. My question is along the same lines, but since you mentioned income and you're talking about how important it is that participants report their income correctly, is there a definition of income for purposes of what these participants are supposed to report? And is that definition in English? or in other languages?
Well, I believe, Your Honor, there's two answers to the question. One is that it is that there's a general notion or that you should report all of your income, and that's included in the tenant and participant statements of responsibility, which is a part of the record. It's signed yearly and would have been signed by Ms. Mohammed at each of the interpretive meetings. That's gone over in those meetings. So that all of the times that Ms. Mohammed attended interpretive meetings, she would have had that explanation. Likewise, the CDA doesn't, on its application, expect people to just figure out what income is. The application has very detailed questions about specific kinds of income: child support, contributions from other people, contributions in kind, things like that. The application did not change between 2016, 17, 18 with respect to what was being reported. So those same questions would have appeared on the application that was specifically reviewed by Ms. Mohammed with an interpreter early on, at each occasion when she was attending the recertification appointments. I would also point out that even after her mail-in submission in 2018, Ms. Mohammed had conversations with Ms. Anderson, and she could have asked Ms. Anderson if she had any concerns.
Right. I understand that part of the argument, and I think it's helpful to have that part of that, to have a better understanding of her specific capabilities in speaking English. I'm a little more concerned with her ability to understand the written language, especially as it relates to things that would have to be defined terms such as income and what that might include. You mentioned that she had an interpreter in previous years before the switch to mail-in only. And so the question I have is, during those years before the recertification was by mail, when she had an interpreter during those years, was she receiving child support at that point, or is that a change in her own life circumstances that she wouldn't have necessarily even had that conversation with an interpreter before if she didn't have child support? Do you know the timing or the sequence of moving to recertification by mail and when she started receiving child support?
Ms. Mohammed, the mail was in, as I understand it, the 2018 recertification. And I believe that was the first time she reported child support, but she did report child support in 2018. She reported it properly. She was told that her income, or that because of the addition of the child support, her rent would go up. She immediately then stated that her husband was sick and wouldn't be paying the child support. And then the rent was reduced, and at the same, the very same time frame, the cash contribution started. So she did report her child support in 2018. It's just that she immediately then stated that she was no longer getting it when she learned the consequences of having made that report. But the application, that is, people go through it at the recertification hearings with the interpreter. They go through it very methodically. It's as Mr. Zhang said, it is a very extended meeting to make sure that all of the various income categories and all of the information that is being required is specifically addressed on a yearly basis.
Ms. Dobbins, does the record show that the information requested in the annual statement of participant responsibility, that the questions asked and the information contained changed at all between 2014 and 2019?
The documents are all part of the record, the various applications.
And was there, I guess more specifically, was there any change in how the documents described income?
I don't believe so. There is always a series of questions breaking down various possible types of income. And with respect, did I answer your question adequately?
Yes, thank you.
With respect to Ms. Mohammed's understanding, I think that the best indication of Ms. Mohammed's ability to understand was her own actions. She repeatedly, when she had a question, she picked up the phone. She called Ms. Anderson at the CDA. She's had the same housing specialist throughout the entire period. They had extended conversations that are fully documented in the record. And Ms. Mohammed was free and did avail herself of the ability to ask Ms. Anderson questions. And she repeatedly fully complied with Ms. Anderson's request, even in situations that were somewhat challenging. For example, when she wanted to remove her husband from the lease, she was told that she had to do it in writing, which she did right away. Then she was told that she also had to contact her landlord and get her husband taken off of the lease. She communicated with Ms. Anderson about how to do that. She informed Ms. Anderson that her landlord was out of town and that there would be a delay, and she negotiated that entire process. So Ms. Mohammed was fully capable and did repeatedly contact the CDA when she had questions. And she followed through with respect to everything she was, or to the items that she was asked to provide and to obtain. There's nothing in the record until this case began that would show that she didn't understand what was happening. And the CDA actually would argue that the sequence of events in 2018 actually is the best evidence that Ms. Mohammed understood what was what the impact of child support would be, and that the timing in particular creates a strong inference that she reported the child support, she knew it would increase her rent. She then said that he wouldn't be paying the child support, the rent gets reduced, and she immediately starts getting cash payments from her ex-husband. There is an indication also in some of the records from the phone calls between Ms. Mohammed and Ms. Anderson that are part of the record, that at least on one occasion, Ms. Mohammed provided varying responses with respect to what the purpose of the cash deposits were. Now she's claiming that it was for items for her children and she had no ability to not do, for example, pick them out to eat or whatever. There is at least one note in the record where she said that her ex-husband was assisting her in paying her rent, which would be a category that would be more typical for child support. I mean, everything that goes to the children would fit the definition of child support, but I just wanted to note that in the record, there is at least one notation that she told Ms. Anderson that he was helping her pay the rent. But it is clear, based not only on the application, but also on the zero child support document, that Ms. Mohammed answered a series of very specific questions about various categories of contributions and income. That those questions were very specific. She knew that she could, if she had questions, she could have called Ms. Anderson at any time, because she did frequently call Ms. Anderson to ask questions and to ask for clarification. At no time did she tell Ms. Anderson that she needed an interpreter. And in fact, she routinely reached out to Ms. Anderson directly without an interpreter, and then successfully navigated the issues that she was speaking to Ms. Anderson about. The cash contributions is the first time that she has alleged that she didn't understand something. But the CDA would argue that the sequence of events allow an inference that she did indeed understand what the impact of reporting that those dollars would have been, which would be that her rent would have gone up. With respect to the VAWA issue, I just briefly want to point out that there is no direct relationship between any alleged domestic abuse and the failure to report. All of the conduct that is a part of the termination in this case took place long after Ms. Muhammad's ex-husband had left the household. And in fact, appears to be have happened with the cooperation of Ms. Muhammad's ex-husband. He certified in writing first that he was going to pay child support, then that he wasn't, and he is the source of the $4,000+ worth of cash deposits that were made into Ms. Muhammad's account. So rather than an instance of a direct result between domestic abuse and the conduct, in this instance, he seems to have been cooperating with the conduct. The other issue that I would like to briefly address is the whole interpretation issue. The CDA can't read minds. At no time between 2014 and this proceeding did Ms. Muhammad or anyone acting on her behalf tell the CDA that the interpretation services were inadequate. There certainly should be a burden on her to tell the CDA, she's in regular communication with Ms. Anderson, that the interpretation services were inadequate or somehow offensive. She said that she couldn't understand a word that was spoken by the interpreter, but at the same time understands the demeaning comments that he made, which is inconsistent. But most importantly, beginning in 2014, Ms. Muhammad attended interpreted meetings at the CDA. After those meetings, she fully complied with the CDA's requirements. She did what they asked her to do. When she had questions, she called the CDA and asked and talked to Ms. Anderson. At no point in this entire process did she say that she couldn't understand, that she needed further interpretive services, or that somehow the interpretive services that were being provided to her were inadequate. Based upon the record in this case and all of the evidence, the CDA asks that you affirm the hearing officer's decision.
Thank you very much. Shoshong, rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, I did want to address your question to Ms. Dobbins about the timeline of the change in the types of income Ms. Muhammad had in comparison to the shift to a male-only recertification. So 2018 was the year the CDA moved to a male-only recertification, and that was also the first year that Ms. Muhammad would receive what is called, what would be considered child support for the voucher program. Prior to that, Mr. Zaman Mayani was still in the household in 2017. And so for that year, 2018, it was a new kind of income that Ms. Muhammad had never experienced before. And then it was her responsibility to read all the questions Ms. Dobbins referred to that are entirely in English that detail out what could be considered income.
Ms. Dobbins argues that at that point, Ms. Muhammad included child support and reported it.
Yes, in 2018, as part of the initial package, she did report in that some amount was being received, zero to 400. And once that was processed on the annual basis, Ms. Muhammad then later reported that Mr. Mayani was in the hospital and no
longer. Right, but the point is whether she understands the definition of income, which is given to her in English or not. And the fact that she was able to respond in 2018, doesn't that indicate that she understood what those different income categories meant, even though it had only been provided in writing?
In the record, it will show that for that line that Ms. Muhammad did fill out to indicate she was receiving zero to 400, the box is actually marked no, that she doesn't receive any income, and then is put there saying that she does receive it. And so I think that the record does demonstrate that she does have a deficient understanding of what this income should count for.
Let me ask another question too, which is, why is the language block itself not sufficient? Because you said that is in different languages. And why is that not enough to comply with the requirements for the agency?
That is not sufficient, Your Honor, because it places the burden solely on Ms. Muhammad to seek her own meaningful language access from the CDA. 2017 on back, the CDA was taking affirmative and reasonable steps to provide language access to Ms. Muhammad. They automatically provided an interpreter every single year for annual recertification meetings.
No, I understand that you say that's sufficient, but there's lots of different responses that the agency could potentially provide. My specific question is, putting aside having an army of interpreters ready to interpret any language at any time, what less than that is required? And why isn't it sufficient to say in lots of different languages, if you need an interpreter, call this line?
For Ms. Muhammad, that is not sufficient to provide meaningful access because it's in writing. I think a sufficient process for the CDA to have undertaken in 2018, if it wished to move to mail only, would have been either to default to have Ms. Muhammad as a limited English proficient participant continue to come in person, or a lesser, less burdensome thing to do would have been to affirmatively call Ms. Muhammad on the phone. So it's an oral communication as opposed to written communication and ask with an interpreter.
But Mr. Zhang, how do we know that what CDA decided to do, and that is include the language block in different languages, including Somali, saying, if you need help, call this number. How do we know that's not enough when in fact your client didn't even call the number?
It's not enough because it's then putting the burden on Ms. Muhammad. Ms. Muhammad has to do something to get meaningful access, whereas beforehand, she didn't have to do anything.
That's what I don't understand. Can you point to the, are you able to hear me? I don't have my...
Again, you're very soft. If you can speak up, we'll have a better chance of hearing you.
Really? Okay. There must be.
That's better.
Wrong with my system. I'm not sure why, but I don't understand why, as a matter of law, your client cannot be terminated based upon a failure to provide interpretive services if the agency puts on her the duty to request interpretive services. I don't understand why the change in the process becomes a legal impediment to termination. Is there some statutory language that you're pointing to that supports that idea, or is it just what you feel is a matter of equity or fairness?
I see my time has run. May I answer the question?
Please.
Under the federal regulations, it is the CDA's responsibility to take steps, and under the CDA's own administrative plan, to take affirmative steps to ensure meaningful language access. And by just pointing the finger at Ms. Muhammad saying, hey, if you want help, you have to ask, that is not a reasonable step, and it's not certainly a far cry from an affirmative step to provide meaningful language access. Ms. Muhammad requests this court to reverse the hearing officer's decision and reinstate her voucher.
All right, thank you very much, both Ms. Dobbins and Mr. Zhang, for your arguments and your submissions. We will take the matter under advisement and issue an order within the statutory timeframes. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.